It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, amid allegations of gerrymandering in Wisconsin and elsewhere, what would a good electoral map even look like? We'll talk with a geographer who has a few ideas.
First, in a court filing late last night, the Wisconsin Department of Justice asked a Dane County judge to push back the deadline for Governor Scott Walker to call special elections to fill two vacant legislative seats.
That deadline is currently set for Thursday, but Walker wants it changed to April 6th, a week from Friday. That's because lawmakers may pass a bill that would cancel those special elections. It would also end the requirement that governors quickly call special elections when there are vacancies in the legislature. A court hearing to consider Walker's request to delay the deadline is scheduled to begin in about 20 minutes.
Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson will be covering that hearing at the Dane County Courthouse. He joins us now to bring us up to speed on the legal and legislative happenings on this story. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Judith.
There's a lot going on with this story, obviously, so let's start in the legislature. Senate Republicans rolled out a bill yesterday afternoon that would restrict special elections in Wisconsin. What exactly are they proposing, Sean?
I think a couple of the big things in the bill would restrict special elections in a couple ways. So one, special elections would no longer be allowed in Wisconsin after the state's regularly scheduled spring election if it's a year when there's a November general election. So let's put that in the context of this year. And we have an April 3rd spring election and we have a November general election. So this year, there would be no special elections allowed after April 3rd. The other provision in the bill would say that a governor has to wait at least 4 months between the time that he orders a special election and the election date. So at that point, you kind of have to walk the calendar backward from April 3rd. And what it essentially means is that you'd never have any special elections or vacancies that occur in December of an odd number year or later. So you could have year-long vacancies in Wisconsin become, more of a norm.
And that's the situation right now with these two open seats, correct?
That's the situation now. And what happened is these two seats were vacated in late December. They were held by former State Representative Keith Ripp in the 42nd Assembly District and former State Senator Frank Lassay in the 1st State Senate District. They left for jobs in the Walker administration, and Governor Walker said that the usual state law did not apply to him in these cases when it comes to calling special elections, because normally current state law says that if a vacancy occurs before the second Tuesday in May of an election year, a governor has to call a special election. Governor Walker said that since the vacancies occurred in 2017 and 2018, that rule did not apply to him. Judge Joanne Reynolds last week said that that would lead to an interpretation of the law that was, quote, absurd in its application, and she ruled against Walker. And so what's happening now is the legislature, instead of trying to appeal Walker's initial argument on how to read this law, the legislature is now trying to change the law.
So can the legislature change the law and basically make it retroactive in a way, because it would seem more logical that this would apply moving forward, but they're actually trying to change this and therefore kind of circumvent this legal decision.
I'm sure that's going to be a question that is argued over in court and, potentially ultimately decided by our state Supreme Court if the legislature were to pass this law, because typically a law would apply to stuff moving forward, and this particular bill that Republican senators are considering would apply, it states that it would apply retroactively, and it states that it would apply regardless of any court order. So essentially that part of the bill was tailor-made for the case that's in front of us right now, where these vacancies exist now, the governor is under a court order now, but this bill that's before the legislature would say, whether it can do that or not, would say that that it applies retroactively and applies to this court order.
So that March 29th deadline was set by Judge Joanne Reynolds, but the Senate just rolled out this bill yesterday. When would they actually be taking it up? I'm guessing not before this Thursday deadline.
There's going to be a public hearing on the bill tomorrow, and the full Senate is scheduled to vote on the bill in an extraordinary session on April 4th. So why today's hearing is important is that, you know, without the court essentially changing its initial ruling, Governor Walker either has to call these elections, even though he knows that the legislature is going to change the law, or he would not call them and then, you know, be in violation of a court order. So because there's a gap between March 29th and April 4th, and we're going to see what Judge Richard Neese, who's now assigned to this case, at least for today, has to say about the DOJ's request to extend that deadline.
We're talking with Sean Johnson. He's Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief, and he's bringing us up to date on the situation regarding whether or not the Walker administration will have to call for special elections to fill two vacant legislative seats, or whether the legislature will have time to create law to make that avoided decision. And Sean, so this appeal today is not going in front of the same judge. It's going in front of Judge Richard Neese instead. What do we know about him?
We know he was appointed to the bench initially by former Democratic Governor Jim Doyle, whereas Judge Joseann Reynolds, who issued the initial ruling in this case, was appointed by Governor Walker in 2014. We know that Judge Richard Neese has been in the news in decisions involving state government in the past. He ruled against Wisconsin's voter ID law. I believe that was back in 2012. Even when the Supreme Court issued an order to him in that case, essentially telling him that he was wrong, he removed himself from the case rather than execute the order. So, I mean, he felt strongly in that case that the voter ID law that passed the legislature was unconstitutional. So he has, we don't know what he hasn't said anything about this case yet today, so we don't know where he's at when it comes to special election laws, but he has had a history of being at odds with Governor Walker and Wisconsin Republicans, or at least at odds with a law that they passed.
So as we said, Sean, Senate Republicans rolled out their version of a bill yesterday afternoon. Where does the Assembly fit into this equation?
All we know so far is that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has been basically on the same page in his public remarks as Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. I mean, he's been out there. He joined Fitzgerald's call for this extraordinary session, which is an option that legislative leaders have for them to bring the legislature back to Madison when they're not in regular session. So Voss and Fitzgerald seem to be on the same page. We haven't heard Voss go into specifics on this bill and some of the timelines that are laid out in the bill. But he seems to be on the same page as Fitzgerald, and the governor seems to be on the same page as Fitzgerald, at least in the broad strokes. He said that he's going to sign the bill that the legislature passes, even though he does say that, you know, he'd be open to some changes on the very specific timing.
So Republican leadership and the governor are on the same page. What do we know, or what are we hearing from Democrats or rank-and-file Republicans?
What you're hearing from Democrats is that they're calling this a corrupt abuse of power. They say that Republicans are doing this because they're afraid that they're going to lose in these special elections. There was a special election in a state Senate district earlier this year in January where a seat that had been held by a Republican, the 10th state Senate district, flipped to Democrats. And Democrat Patty Schachner won that seat with double-digit victory. And that was a seat that President Trump had won by 17 percentage points back in 2016. So Democrats feel like, public opinion is swinging toward them in this election year. And they feel like this is an attempt to, by Republicans to block that.
And Sean, as we wrap up, remind us what's happening in just about 15 minutes from now.
Just about 15 minutes, Dane County Judge Richard Neese is going to convene a hearing to consider a request by Wisconsin's Department of Justice, which is representing Governor Walker, to extend a court order deadline for Walker to call special elections in two vacant legislative districts. The DOJ wants to extend that deadline to give the legislature time to rewrite the laws, and essentially would mean that those vacancies would no longer have to be filled if the legislature gets its way. DOJ is asking Dean County Judge Richard Neese to give the legislature time to do that.
Well, Sean, thanks for giving us the background, and we will check back in with you in a couple hours to get the decision by the judge.
All right. Thanks, Judith.
Thanks, Sean. Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief, and again, we'll get an update from Sean on the court proceedings after 5 o'clock today. Right now, the U.S. Supreme Court is set to issue an opinion on Gill versus Whitford this summer. That's a case arguing that Wisconsin's political districts were gerrymandered or shaped for political gain.
But even when there aren't allegations of gerrymandering, redistricting can get complicated. Districts end up oddly shaped, respecting so-called communities of interest.
So what would a good congressional district map even look like? Garrett Dash Nelson tried to find out and wrote about it in a piece for the website City Lab. He's a historical geographer at the Society of Fellows at Dartmouth College, and he joins us now. Garrett, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Why is redistricting so complicated?
Well, it's really hard to split up any type of space into segments that each have the same population. If you think about how states are laid out, some of them have one big city in the middle, some of them have many different sized cities spread out across different combinations of rural areas and unpopulated areas. So when you want to cut a state up into portions for electoral districts, it's really tricky to decide how best to do that in the fairest possible way.
And gerrymandering has only really loosely been defined legally so far. Why is that, and how do you define gerrymandering?
Yeah, so gerrymandering is usually used to refer to the process of dividing electoral districts up specifically so that one party has partisan advantage across a whole state or whatever kind of territory that you're districting. So if one party holds the basically strings or the, you know, the map drawing power, what they can do is they can draw shapes of districts that essentially maximize how many seats that they can get by creating as many possible districts that are favorable to their party and minimizing the number of districts that are favorable to another party. Now, it's really hard to define what counts as gerrymandering because people naturally cluster according to all sorts of reasons that aren't perfectly spread out, right? So you may have, for instance, more Democrats in a city and more Republicans in a rural area. So even if you were to, quote-unquote, naturally divide an area up into electoral districts, there might be a partisan imbalance there. What we want to find out with gerrymandering is basically there a even worse partisan imbalance than the one you might expect to find otherwise.
So what are some of the benchmarks that you look for that indicate that this is districting that has been put in place to favor one party or the other versus those kind of natural ways that people tend to cluster?
So up to this point, most political scientists and demographers and lawyers have basically looked at electoral outcomes. So if a state is, let's say, 55% Democratic voters, but 80% of the representatives end up being Republicans, that's a clue that gerrymandering has probably gone on. What I'm interested in as a geographer is, could you actually tell based on the lines on the map without even having to look at the electoral outcomes, without counting up how many Republicans, how many Democrats are in each district, how many Republicans, how many Democrats get elected to seats, could you actually look at those electoral borders and say, this one doesn't seem to make sense because it kind of either cuts crazily across the map, it doesn't really match with any type of community that we would recognize. Are there ways of finding gerrymandered patterns based on geography rather than based on partisanship?
Well, and you used what I thought was a really interesting element to look at whether these districts make sense or not, and it's data on how people commute. Why did you choose that as a point to use in looking at whether lines are drawn well or drawn poorly?
Yeah, so one of the hunches about the geography of electoral districts is that places that are connected together should ideally vote together, right? So a community that's connected by social, political, economic ties should, as much as possible, form a single electoral district. So the question becomes, how do you measure those kind of ties, right? There are all sorts of ways that people are connected across space. And just so happens that one of the kind of data sets that's both easy to measure and that we have pretty good comprehensive data on is commutes. So the U.S. Census Bureau looks at where people live and where they work, and the connection between those is basically treated as a commute. So when we look at commutes across an entire state, we can say that the areas where people are commuting back and forth kind of make up a community. Now, that's not a perfect definition, but it's a pretty good one. So, for instance, people in Dane County are probably commuting mostly to Madison, not so much to Superior or places
right.
on the other side of the state. So what we can do then when we're interested in electoral districting is to look at how well do the districts kind of encapsulate whole sets of commuters. We want districts that keep commuters together rather than cutting them apart.
We're talking right now with Garrett Dash Nelson. He's a historical geographer at the Society of Fellows at Dartmouth College, and we're talking about using commuter data to inform districting and redistricting. And Garrett, some states are already doing a good job kind of looking at this particular way of measuring it. What is it about those states, and what are some of the states that are doing well that put them in this category?
Well, most states actually have some sort of law on the books that says an electoral district should match what's called a community of interest, is typically the term that's used. The thing is that oftentimes they don't define these communities of interest very well. They say something along the lines of regions of a state that are connected by social or economic ties should stay together within a district. Now, again, that's kind of a combination of both data analysis and a hunch, right? You might have a sense of which part of a state kind of belongs together in that way. So some states have put districting in the hands of some nonpartisan entity, like a commission that's made up of representatives of both parties, or by maybe scientists or geographers or statisticians who sit on a board like that. In those cases, they oftentimes do get it right in the sense of keeping these regions together as much as possible.
And what about states that aren't doing well, that don't score well on the ways of looking at good districting? What are they doing wrong?
Well, so again, when we look at these commuter patterns, essentially what we're doing is testing how many commuter patterns stay enclosed within a district and how many commuter patterns are cut across. How many electoral boundaries cut through big flows of commuters going from one place to the other. And when we find in a state, for instance, Pennsylvania, which has been in the news recently, when we find that the districts cut a lot of commutes, then that suggests to us that probably one party or the other has drawn some tricky lines in order to maximize their own advantage. It suggests that they're kind of cutting across these sort of natural clusters of where people live, and they're doing that essentially to rig the numbers of elections in their favor.
The U.S. Supreme Court is currently considering whether Wisconsin's districts were gerrymandered. You don't have Wisconsin as ranking as one of the best or the worst, so it's somewhere in the middle. What does Wisconsin look like when you use this kind of data?
Yeah, so I actually looked at how Wisconsin's state electoral districts, so not their, it's actually not the federal congressional mm-hmm. districts that are at issue here, but for the state assembly. One of the problems there is that assembly districts are so small that no matter how you draw them, they're going to cut some commuter borders. So it doesn't work quite as well as when we're talking about larger districts like a U.S. House district, but you can still actually put up or detect a pattern. So I looked at Wisconsin's assembly map before, is it 2012 or 2011, I think it mm-hmm. was redistricted, and then after. And the effect's much smaller than when you look at something like Pennsylvania's U.S. House districts, but it's there. So the newer map that was drawn by the Republicans actually does cut more commutes. It's worse in terms of containing commuter patterns. So again, what that offers us is some statistical evidence that gerrymandering has gone on here. That kind of evidence exists in other ways. The most famous is this statistic called the efficiency gap, which looks at the number of votes that are essentially wasted when a party doesn't win an electoral district. But what I'm trying to do is to look not just at the number of votes, not just in the partisan counts of each district, but actually how well or how poorly the districts match up with the kind of underlying patterns of human geography.
And Garrett, as we wrap up, I'm guessing this won't ever exist, but what would a perfect electoral map look like?
Well, that's one of the things that's so tricky, is there really is no perfect district for a couple of reasons. The first is that everything's sort of connected together, right? So you don't have any regions or, you know, urban areas that are totally cut off at their borders, that nobody connects across. That's just the way we live in this kind of spatially interconnected way. The second reason is that even if those did exist, they definitely wouldn't exist in the perfect numbers that, you know, you need a district to be. So it's not like a city gets to be about 600,000, which is the size of a U.S. House district, and then it just stops growing. So you have to cut through these areas somehow. So perfect isn't, I would say, what we're going after. What we're going after is electoral districts that make sense as much as possible, that as best as they can, given the constraints, try to respect the underlying geography of how people actually live.
Well, Garrett, thanks so much for joining us. Really interesting information.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Thanks for the chat.
Garrett Dash Nelson is a historical geographer. He was with us to imagine what a good electoral map could look like. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina.
Much like your first love or your first job, everyone remembers their first car. Maybe it was an old beater with broken knobs and gauges that leaked oil everywhere. Or perhaps it was something sporty and flashy and ran like a dream.
Whatever the case, you probably have stories and memories about that car, like epic road trips or epic breakdowns. As part of the History Channel's series last summer, The Cars That Made America, several celebrities reminisced about their old cars. Here's Tim Allen, Wyclef Jean, Pilar Lastra, and Dee Snider.
My first car was a 66 Corvair Corsa, and I promptly learned what oversteer was, and I wrecked it. And on the way to getting it back, I hit it again.
My first car ever, LTD station wagon. I called them the ghetto limo. But we used to at least fit like 11 in that car going to a party. We pull up and then the back door opens and you see like people crawling out of the car.
My very first car was a 1989 Dodge Colt and it sucked. I was never gonna be the popular girl with that car.
The first day I had it, the heater cord blew and I never had heat again in the car and it burnt oil and it was a bomb. But it was still my first car. I called it Seabiscuit.
New Central Time producer Bill Martins recently parted with his first vehicle, and he joins us here in the studio. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Judith.
So what was your first car?
First car was a 2001 Ford Taurus. That was a college graduation gift from mom and dad in 2003. So it was just a baby when I got it. Kind of a spring green tan color, 18,000 miles. And man, I drove that thing pretty much every day up until about a month ago. So almost 15 years.
So would you say this was a pretty good car then, Bill?
Yeah, it held up really well. Mechanically, you know, when you have a car for a long time, things fail and you have to get parts replaced. That's nothing unusual. But the biggest problem was probably the rust, because it wasn't until about 2 years ago that my wife and I got a house that had a garage. Mm-hmm. And before that, you know, it just sat outside all the time, especially in winter. I wasn't very good at getting it washed. You know, water does a funny thing when it gets really cold out. It freezes.
What?
Yeah, I know. Get out of here, right? So, you know, all the salt and slop just ate away at it. And the color hid dirt really, really well. So even during the summer, it always looked clean. So I never really got it washed. And, you know, the rust just kind of gradually ate it away.
So that's what brought you to having to get rid of it?
Yeah, you know, it was last summer I took it to the shop to have some routine work done. And as long as they were going to have it up on the lift, I said, hey, can you guys just give me a rust assessment here? Because, you know, you can see the rust along the back wheels really bad, but you can't really tell what's going on underneath. And so they put it up there, and there were nickel and dime size holes in the frame.
Oof.
Right underneath the engine.
Oh,
probably not where you want to have holes in your car,
no.
Right? And so they suggested don't even put any more money into this car, save it for a new one, and that's what I did.
So what happened to the car then? I know that you've got a new car now, but, you know, I think there's always that temptation to, like, give your old car the good old Viking funeral or something. What ended up happening to it?
I wound up having that towed away. I was, you know, it. So when they told me not to put any more money into it, I did not put any more money into it. And the drive home that last day was really kind of scary. It was kind of like, you know, when you're driving a vehicle on a really windy day, you can feel it blow around a little bit.
Sure.
My car was doing that on calm days.
Ooh.
And it was making all kinds of weird noises and stuff. So I was thankful just to get the thing home. And I didn't even trust being able to take it to a salvage yard. I couldn't give it to anybody because I just couldn't. I didn't want to doom anybody with that.
Not to mention the liability.
Exactly, probably. Exactly. So, yeah, it's in Ford Taurus heaven now.
So what did you replace it with?
2002 Ford Explorer. Another oldie. So this was, it was kind of weird how this came about. So my dad passed away in December. And when I was up there for the funeral, Mom was like, you know, would you have any interest in, you know, Dad's Explorer? And I thought, yeah, absolutely. And my wife and I wanted an SUV anyway to carry stuff around and just a nice bigger vehicle. And so, but we weren't going to get it until Mom bought a brand new car because my dad liked to collect cars. Mom didn't want to do any of that. So she wanted to get rid of all of them. So she bought herself a brand new Buick Encore. And once she did that, she was able to sell us the Explorer. And then it was bye-bye Taurus.
So, Bill, if I did my math right, you had your first car for about 15 years.
Right.
In comparison, I had my first car for about a year and a half before it finally bit the dirt. I would imagine during that time you racked up a lot of good memories with this car. What was your favorites?
You know, to be honest with you, I can't really think of a specific memory. I didn't take it on any crazy road trips. I didn't have any, you know, as you said, epic breakdowns or anything like that. It was just a matter of driving that car nearly every day for 15 years, and there's just something comforting about what's familiar. Even the quirky stuff, like this drove my wife nuts, but she didn't have the right touch to it, I'm convinced. So when you had to turn the volume knob on the radio just right in order to turn the volume down. If you didn't do it just right, it just got louder and louder,
my gosh,
and would blow you out of the car. So you had to have just the right touch, and I'm pretty sure I was the only one who could do it. And I couldn't. Not every single time I was able to get it right, but most of the time I did.
So clearly, Bill, it was time for the Taurus to go to Taurus heaven, as
right.
you said. But do you ever miss it?
Sometimes, especially, you know, when I'm out at the grocery store or out driving around and I see one that kind of looks like that, you know, it kind of brings back some memories. It was harder, I think, like maybe the last week or so, just when I knew that I was going to be doing away with it. It's like, oh, this might be the last time I put gas in it, or the last time I drive it here, or the last time I do this. So that part was hard, but I really love the Explorer, and that kind of has taken away any sort of weird feelings.
Did you save any mementos?
I did. I ripped off the Ford decal off the grill, and it's hanging up in the office now.
Oh,
it's covered in salt. It needs a bath.
We'll have to come by and check that out. Well, Bill, thanks for joining us and sharing the story.
Yeah, that was fun. Thank you.
Bill Martins is a new producer for Central Time, and he was here telling us about his first car.
And now it's time for you to tell us about your first car at 800-642-1234. What was it? How did you get it? Did you buy it, or was it a hand-me-down? What do you remember the most about it? And how did you feel when you finally parted with it? Maybe you're still driving it right now. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org.
Joining us now to talk about that strong emotional bond we often have with our first cars is Michael Marsden. He's Professor Emeritus of English, American Studies, and Media Studies at St. Norbert College. He's an expert on the automobile in American culture. And Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith. It's good to be back with you.
So we have to ask, what was your first car?
My first car was a 1951 Mercury four-door. It had what they call opera doors that opened to the center back in front. It had full skirts on it, and it was what they call a semi-automatic, which meant you put it in first and second gear, but not the third gear. You put it in first gear, second and third were just clutchless. So it was an interesting car.
And how long did you drive this car for?
I drove it for only a few years, maybe 3 or 4 years, and I sold it to my brother. And so he drove it for a couple of years. One of the quirks of it, because it had a very, I guess, a hot engine, and basically it would vapor lock on the fuel pump all the time. So whenever I went on a date, I'd have to carry a can of water with me to jump over the fuel pump or break the vapor lock.
That's always a chick magnet, isn't it, when you have to fix the car as you're going?
Right, exactly.
Well,
my first car.
Why do you think we have such an attachment to whatever our first vehicle is whenever we get it?
I think partly is because I think historically this is certainly true for generations. And I think what happens is it's associated with freedom and mobility, and it's our opportunity to explore the world, to go where we want to go, when we want to go, under what conditions we want to go. And so we're emotionally attached to that object. And certainly you find a lot of baby boomers, for example. I missed them by a few years, but the baby boomers are now collecting a lot of cars from the 60s and 70s and restoring them or buying them restored. So the pony cars, the Mustangs, the Camaros, of those, the Cougars of the 60s, and then the muscle cars of the 70s, because they associated that particular brand or that particular style of car with enormous freedom and mobility. And they will spend a lot of money and time keeping those cars restored.
And, Michael, do you ever have the temptation to go out and try to find another car just like your first car, maybe one with a little bit of a better fuel pump?
Actually, my brother found the exact car.
The exact one?
Not the exact one. I shouldn't say the exact one.
You got us really excited there.
The exact model, which has to be restored. So he beat me to it.
Wow, that's kind of amazing. So I'll share, my first car was a 1972 Olds Delta 88. It was a boat. I mean, this is a huge, huge car. I am rather on the short side, so you could barely see me over like the window on the driver's side. And I bought it from my friend Dave, who we called Deuce, and it was called the Deuce-mobile. So I had the Deuce-mobile, and it definitely had a certain cachet in our little group of friends because it was a super cool car, and I loved that car.
Yeah, and you know, again, other cars too over time that we've had. In fact, I think I bought my last new car in 1968 until this past fall, and I finally ordered a new car. But I can remember each one of those cars, and there was always something associated with those cars. And as you spoke with earlier on the show, that I kept pieces of them, like a hubcap or a part of the car, just to have a memento.
And I'm curious, too, Michael, you know, we heard about, it seems like everyone's first car has their quirk, whether it's the fuel pump, whether it's, you know, Bill's car with the crazy volume control. I remember with my first car, I think it was like the lock on the passenger door didn't work quite right, so you couldn't get into it, so you had to go in through the back seat and then crawl into the front. I mean, is that part of the fun, like when we reminisce about our first cars, that there was something like that we had to overcome almost with them?
I think so, and quirkiness is one of the things we do remember. Over the weekend, I had a chance to talk to three millennials who are college-age millennials, and basically about their first car and did they have an emotional attachment to it. And it was interesting. They said they would never want to go back and try to, you know, buy a restored version of it. They were happy to have it for the freedom and mobility, but they weren't attached to the car itself as much as I think earlier generations were. And talk about quirkiness. One of them told me that what he found most memorable about the car was that one day he lifted up the front mat and found a plant growing on through the floorboard. You know, moisture from the air conditioning system had combined with dirt and had given some proper soil for the plant to grow under the mat.
We're talking with Michael Marsden right now. He's Professor Emeritus of English, American Studies, and Media Studies at St. Norbert College. He's an expert on the automobile in American culture, and we're talking about first cars.
And you can join the conversation as well at 800-642-1234. What was your first car, and how did you get it? What was your favorite memory about that car, good or bad? How did you feel when you finally parted with it? And maybe you're still driving it? What's your secret to success with this car? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation and get to your calls right after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Right now, we're talking about our first cars and the emotional attachment that we have with those vehicles. Michael Marsden is our guest. He's a professor emeritus of English, American Studies, and Media Studies at St. Norbert College. He's also an expert on the automobile and American culture.
And let's go to the phones. And Jack in Neshoah is up first. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Don't say that in the airport. My first car was a 1965 Rambler Classic, four doors. It was black with lots of chrome, red interior.
Ooh.
I had it. My dad gave it to me, and I had it for a month in the spring of my senior year of high school. I drove it to a party and parked it on a very narrow country road.
Uh-oh.
One of my friends had too much to drink. Got in his car and picked mine among all the cars and hit it and totaled it out.
Ooh.
Oh, that had to hurt.
It was tough, but I had the biggest roller coaster ride in the next 12 hours. The next day, I bowled in a tournament, and I won a trip to Washington, D.C. So
wow.
I had the bad and the good.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that, Jack. Yeah, that's tough, especially just a month in. That's still the honeymoon period.
Yeah, I can't imagine having the first car and then just having it taken away from you. Michael, have you heard stories like this from people where, you know, the car ends up crashing in some spectacular fashion?
Oh, yes. And, then, you know, and again... It's the opposite, isn't it? It's not the joy, but the sorrow of losing something that you value, or something that perhaps a parent gave to you, perhaps that is associated with a lot of high emotional things for you, and then it's gone. it's gone because it's been wrecked or stolen. That's another negative, obviously.
Jack, thanks for that call. Let's move next to Green Bay, and Erica is up. Hi, Erica.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My father bought my grandfather's 1969 Buick Wildcat. It had a brown vinyl hard top, and I was really excited, and I didn't realize it was really coveted because it had a really big engine. You don't think of your grandpa driving a car like that. But I used to cruise the main, and I got a lot of attention, so that was fun. But then my dad decided it was time to sell it, so he found this guy, and he said, oh, he's so clean-cut and such a nice young man, and he's got a little boy. Well, it turns out he was a known burglar in the community and came back and burgled our next-door neighbor of all of her sterling. It was terrible.
Oh, no, and used the car?
And he used my grandpa's car as a getaway car.
Oh,
my goodness.
Wow. Well, did that known burglar get known by the police?
Oh, yes. In fact, they didn't believe me. I called them and I said, you know, I found my old car in the neighborhood. I never met the man. And they thought I was just, you know, imagining things. And then I mentioned his name and their eyes perked up and they said, okay, well, just to let you know, he has been known to come back to the scene of the crime, and he has shot at people before. And my parents were out of town, so I was home alone as a teenager. It was a very memorable, scary experience all surrounding my very first really fun car that I was sorry to see go.
Wow. Well, thanks for that story, Erica. And Mike, you know, it seems like these first cars often have these great legends associated with them.
They do. Family stories, personal stories that simply connect through the car. And, you know, in a sense, it's why people collect cars, because they want to have those continued memories and associations. And they simply connect to that object. And, you know, it's a song will bring out at what won't it, a certain emotion at a certain time in your life, and you connect to it. Well, same with cars. These are, I mean, cars, you know, one of the things that when I developed the course on the automobile and American culture, the basic premise was every aspect of American life has been touched by the automobile, you know, from courtship to crime. You know, there are many connections, and important moments in our lives are connected to cars. And I think that, you know, we come home from the hospital in a car, and sadly, we leave this world in a car. When we get our best ride into life, and we're leaving it, ultimately. But so the car is always there at these key moments in our lives. So it's no question that there are these deep emotional attachments to it.
Let's try to get one more call in. Mike in Fond du Lac is up next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My first car was a 1962 Chevy Nova. Was not a muscle car by any chance. It had a 194 cubic inch engine in it. The unique thing about this car is you'd be driving down the road, and it would just die. And you'd pull over to the side of the road. I'd get out, go back by the spare tire, pull out the distributor that I'd got from the junkyard, walk around in front, lift the hood, pull the distributor out. That these distributors, it just ground them up like a baby rattle. I knew from experience where top dead center was on the number one piston, so I'd take the spark plug out, turn the engine over till it looked like it was about top dead center, put the new distributor in, start it up, turn the distributor till it sounded like it was running right, tighten it down, and away I'd go. I put four distributors in this car.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Mike, thank you so much for your call. And, Michael, what I'm taking away from this segment is the next time I'm at a social gathering or a party or something, if I need an icebreaker, asking what your first car was is probably a good go-to option.
It would be. And they could ask them also, were there any quirks about the particular car? Mm-hmm.
Well, and we actually asked our coworkers about their first cars, and we've had so many great calls that we haven't even gotten to that. But, you know, the quirks, Malcolm Brett, who's the director of Broadcast and Media Innovation, says his car was a 1962 Volvo 122S, and the unique carburetors needed adjustments about every 5 minutes or so, it seemed. It seems like a lot of people are repairing these first cars on the fly.
Yeah, they're learning. You have to learn. It's a good learning device, actually. Yes.
And I'm wondering, Michael, as we enter this era where we're hearing a lot about millennials maybe not wanting to get driver's licenses anymore, we're hearing about the incoming movement for driverless cars. Are you worried that maybe we're losing something here if we're moving towards a society that puts a little less value on automobiles?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. We're losing something. The culture is changing. Millennials are delaying getting a driver's license. They're not getting a driver's license. In other words, many of them still get driver's licenses unless they live in a very urban area where they can use public transportation. So they delay it, though. I think that's one of the trends. And again, I think what I learned by talking at least to a few of them, and you know, this is casual, this is not scientific, but is that they're not connected so much to the machine itself, to the object, but they are connected to the mobility and to the freedom and to the openness of the possibilities that the car brings. So I think that's a shift.
It also seems like cars just work better. I was just thinking the other day, like, you just don't see cars broken down along the side of the road as much as you did in past years. So maybe we're losing some of those good stories, too, because the engineering has just advanced.
Well, the engineering has, I mean, if you can, you know, 100,000 miles is nothing for a car today. You go back to 1950, that would have been extraordinary. 80,000 miles on a set of tires today is nothing. You know, go back to the 50s. You know, you're looking to get 10,000 miles out of a set of tires. So when you look at all the technological advances, they are more reliable. We take them more for granted. There are still quirky cars out there.
And we'll leave it there. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Michael Marsden is a professor emeritus of English, American Studies, and Media Studies at St. Norbert College. He joined us to talk about the emotional bond we have with our first cars. And you can tell us all about your first car over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bonus points if you've got a photo to share. let's be honest, as much as we might try to eat healthy, there are times when you just have to have that bag of chips or perhaps a sleeve of Girl Scout cookies. And for many snack enthusiasts, it is a great time to be alive.
We now live in a world where snacks like Peeps flavored Oreos and Moscow Mule kettle chips not only exist, but are readily available. I've eaten both. It seems like if you can dream it, someone will make it. But not everyone is on board with this trend of outlandish snack flavors.
A recent piece in GQ caught our eye, and really, how could it not, with the headline, "There are too many flavors and it has turned the snack industry into a vicious hellscape." That is a direct quote. It might be a little hyperbolic, certainly, but the author certainly gets her point across. Naturally, that sparked some discussion around the office about the proliferation of snack flavors. And of course, Chris Molina was at the focus of that. Chris?
You know, Rob Ferret calls me the weird snack guy, and I've developed a reputation that I'm not necessarily proud of, but, you know, I enjoy trying these things. I know I'm falling for these marketing schemes hook, line, and sinker, because I know people are eating better, so they're trying to, you know, get consumers back in by going for the wacky flavors. And it's working. I'm falling for it.
So I'm more of a traditionalist, but you were sharing some of the interesting ones. I have to say, Moscow Mule, is it chips? That sounds kind of good.
They were pretty good. It was sort of like salt and ginger flavored with a little bit of lime. And then we also talked about the Extreme Dill Pickle chips, which I'm totally for.
All right, we'll have to share a Pringles can of
Extreme
that.
Extreme and Dill Pickle don't often go together, but I'm glad that they did.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. This is Central Time.